Welcome to this special conversation where we are about to explore with a very special guest how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Dr. Sanjay Gupta is a practicing neurosurgeon and CNN's multiple Emmy Award-winning chief medical correspondent. He hosts the network's weekend health program, Sanjay Gupta MD, and makes frequent appearances on American Morning, Larry King Live, and Anderson Cooper 360. Dr. Gupta has launched CNN's anti-obesity initiative, Fit Nation, and his powerful CNN special, The Last Heart Attack, has educated millions of people about the power of their diet to change their heart health and their lives. Dr. Gupta has been chosen by People magazine as one of the world's sexiest celebrities, and he's author of several best-selling books, including Chasing Life and Cheating Death. Dr. Gupta is currently under contract with CNN, and CNN has asked us to state that this interview with Dr. Gupta is conducted independent of the Food Revolution Summit, and we are pleased to share it with you now. So now, for the interview itself, I'm going to hand it over to my dad and colleague, Food Revolution Network president and best-selling author, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Sanjay, for being with us today.
Thank you, John. Really appreciate it. I'm honored.
Your documentary, The Last Heart Attack, was originally a Dr. Sanjay Gupta special, and it really did have a tremendous impact. While doing the documentary, you interviewed President Clinton, who radically improved his diet and became essentially vegan after undergoing a quadruple bypass in 2004 for blocked arteries. He was strongly influenced by the works of Dr. Dean Ornish and Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, among others, who have each conducted serious research showing that with the kind of diet Clinton adopted, we actually could prevent nearly all heart attacks and could also reverse many forms of advanced heart disease. So what I want to ask you, Sanjay, is did you learn anything while doing that documentary that changed the way you eat?
I think that when I was in medical school and even during my training, there is this sort of notion, I think, in part culturally, in part based on the teachings from our professors, that, you know, things become fixed. If you develop a certain amount of blockage in your arteries, your coronary arteries in this case, that's fixed. You can't really do anything about it other than having an angioplasty or having surgery to bypass those vessels. I think what was sort of striking to me, and I knew this going in, was this idea that people were saying, look, without new medications, without having an invasive procedure, you could reverse heart disease. Now, for a lot of people, they've known that for a long time, and again, I'd heard about that. But I think when you look at Caldwell Esselstyn's data, and by the way, some of his, you know, this predecessor's work of T. Colin Campbell with the China study, you had evidence that the diet could actually reverse what people had previously thought was something that you were going to have for life. It was a personal thing as well, to some extent, because I have a bad family history of heart disease. So I was very interested in that part of it.
And did anything fine-tune your understanding then of the connection between food and heart disease and the potential to reverse it?
Well, when we do a documentary like this, it's exhaustive in terms of what we will look at. You know, certainly we want to tell the stories of people who clearly have lived and are making, you know, the point that we're talking about. But we also obviously want to bolster that up with real data, because we don't want this to be just an anecdotal story where someone will watch and say, oh, well, that's fine for that one person, but what about everybody else? You're not telling me that, you know, adopting a plant-based diet is going to reverse my heart disease. Maybe it worked for that person. So we want to make sure we actually bolster it up with data, that we show the images. I think when people look inside a coronary vessel, look at it, and they see the blockage, and they look at it again after someone has had a plant-based intervention, if you will, those things leave an impression. I changed my diet, John, you know, as a result of this as well, because, you know, my goal was to say, look, in part selfishly, I don't want to have heart problems. I got my genes somewhat stacked against me, but I'm hearing more and more that, you know, I can be in control. That's what I wanted.
Well, a lot of people, I think, who watched the documentary, The Last Heart Attack, walked away from it understanding, perhaps for the first time, that the best weapon against heart disease may not be surgical interventions, may not be drugs, but could rather be something much simpler, changing the way we eat. Do you think that this might not be true just about heart disease, that our best weapon against other chronic diseases might be the food we eat also?
I do believe that food can be a very important and also very durable medicine, if you will. I use medicine in the broadest sense of the term, but when it comes to many of the chronic diseases that we talk about, not only is it effective, and I think, you know, again, there's data that shows that, not just from the United States, but from places around the world, but also durable. I mean, I watch family members go through, you know, heart surgery and have these invasive things done to them. And, you know, look, I was very thankful for it because I think it certainly improved, if not saved their lives. But the idea that they were going to continue to have the same problem, that we weren't solving it, we were just delaying it, that always weighed on me a bit. So the idea that something could be both effective and durable in terms of how long it's going to last, it's clearly, I think, food and the way that we consume it makes a huge difference.
When I think about food and medicine, I remember some famous quotes from the past. Henry David Thoreau once said, "People may deem themselves happy when that which they eat is also their medicine." And Hippocrates, the original author of the Hippocratic Oath, which even today is taken by physicians and considered a rite of passage for practitioners of medicine in many countries, famously said, "Let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food." But now in recent years, we've had a massive number of studies showing us that eating plenty of vegetables and fruits, for example, is linked to a lower risk for many chronic and potentially life-shortening diseases. Mm-hmm. Yet, and this is the thing that concerns me, less than a quarter of the medical schools in the United States today have even a single required course in nutrition. And of the 130 accredited medical schools in the country, only four have a nutrition department. Sanjay, do you think that mainstream medicine is only just beginning to understand the enormous power of excellent nutrition?
Absolutely. When I was in medical school, I had no nutrition classes. Most of what I've learned about nutrition, probably all of it, has been on my own, you know, reading and talking to people like you and people who really spent the time with not only the outcome study, but the mechanistic studies, looking at, you know, okay, it works. Why does it work? You know, is it something that people can incorporate? Anybody can incorporate into their lives. Are there downsides? Are there downsides from adopting just a plant-based diet? We looked at many of those types of things again for the documentary. But I think you're absolutely right. I think mainstream medicine has been slow to adopt and remains slow to adopt it. Slower in the United States versus some other countries. We really wanted to even try and understand why that was. Why? If all the things that you're saying are true and no one disagrees with it, why has there been such slow adoption? And people have different theories on that. I'm happy to share some of mine, but I think there's no question that what you're saying is true. My medical school, I went to the University of Michigan, now does have a nutrition segment, if you will, of one of their courses. It's not even an entire course. But I graduated from medical school 24 years ago. So it's taken, you know, a quarter of a century almost for some of these changes to take place.
Well, I would be interested, and I'm sure our listeners would too, in some of your understandings and theories and speculations about why it is taking so long. What is the resistance?
You know, I think in some ways it's in part human nature. I think with regard to medicine, as well as other fields as well, you know, we like home runs and touchdowns. We like fast, you know, quick abilities to intervene. I mean, the idea that, you know, a stent or an operation or a pill could do things much more quickly than adopting lifestyle changes. And then all that's magnified by the fact that what we're exposed to, I think, on a regular basis is advertising around the types of foods that are not good for us. That advertising starts at a young age. It becomes a real part of the culture here. And I think, you know, as with other, again, elements of our society, there is a problem of becoming a victim of your success when you're able to say that, you know, we have very effective statin medications that can lower cholesterol. People can sometimes look at it as an excuse to eat what they want to eat. I think that that's part of it. There's also sometimes conflicting information that comes out. That, you know, there was a study that came out not that long ago that was really a nonsensical study, but it basically said, look, a vegetarian diet can actually increase the risk of some of these problems that most studies showed that it would decrease the risk of. It wasn't a great study, but the problem is it's sometimes exactly what people want to hear. So it gets trumpeted around and people really buy into it and share it and use it as an excuse to just keep eating, you know, foods that aren't great for them. So there's lots of different reasons. But I think within the medical establishment itself, it seems like it's always in fireman mode. And we don't focus enough on prevention. We already know that. But we don't even focus enough on doing things that work, but just more slowly sometimes than the more expensive and more invasive therapy.
Well, when you mentioned statins, I was thinking about how often doctors prescribe statins to lower low-density lipoprotein levels. And I'm also aware that there could be a better way to do that. I'm thinking about a year-long study that was conducted at the University of Toronto by Dr. David Jenkins. And he created what he calls the portfolio diet, which is essentially a high-fiber, vegan, whole foods diet. And it was shown to lower LDL cholesterol as much as or even more than the blockbuster cholesterol drugs. Now, his kind of a diet may be too strict for some people. But do you think people should at least become aware of, should at least be educated, at least be told by their doctors about this kind of option if the doctor is going to tell them to take statins?
Yeah, I think it absolutely has to be part of what patients are offered in terms of their choices, and they should certainly be educated about it. I do feel like oftentimes for the doctors as well, the idea that a quick fix makes sense. I think the sentiment often is this is what the patients really want to hear. They want the quick fix. We could send them to nutritional counseling. We could educate them about things like the portfolio diet, but it'll take longer. It'll require more follow-up visits. It's going to require a certain amount of diligence from the patients. Are we perhaps doing our patients a disservice? That's what some of the medical community will say, by not ensuring that we get that LDL level down as quickly as possible. In a way that we think they're going to be more compliant. That I think it's not particularly complicated, I think, the thinking, and I don't think I can speak certainly for all doctors. I think, look, it can be as soon as someone says we're going to be talking more about soy-based foods, there are patients who will say, no thanks, not for me. Or if we're talking about, you know, sticky fiber and incorporating more of it into your diet, some people are going to say, no thanks, you know, that's not for me. Because the follow-up part of that discussion is, look, here's what we're talking about. You know, we're talking about using products to just thicken the foods that you're already taking, using preferred vegetables. Here's what they are. You know, John, what's sort of striking to me, and I think this is in part the journalist in me, even more so than the doctor, is that I think medicine has had a very didactic approach to these things. Here is what you should do, okay? That's what you should do. Here, I'm telling you, this is what you should do. And people kind of say, "Well, why should I do that? And how does it work?" I think if you take the extra beat, and I'm not saying you got to spend extra hours with patients, even. I'm saying you take the extra beat to explain. Well, here's how it works, and they understand because they're very interested in their bodies. They're interested in understanding their bodies. That's the most intimate thing they know. If you can really explain why portfolio diet could be beneficial and avoid taking medications, of which, by the way, some of these medications have side effects, I think people are much more likely to be compliant with it. I saw that just in my own anecdotal observations around last heart attack because lots of people were asking me about it, and I would say, here's why some of this works. Here's why you don't have to eat a lot of meat to get protein, something you hear about. There are other sources. Here's what it can do to your coronary arteries. Let me show you inside your body. It tends to be, something that's going to stick with people a lot more. But I think patients should absolutely know. They should know. And they do a lot of research on their own already. They'll go online and look for the stuff. We got to make sure, as you guys do, that the quality of what they're seeing is of the highest quality possible.
I agree. I listen to a lot of nutritional experts, and I look at a lot of the studies, and it seems to me that there is a consensus about a lot of things among people who really do follow the literature. Most of the nutritional experts that I've spoken with eat a whole foods, plant-strong diet. They vary in how much fat they eat. They vary in whether or they eat fish or not. They vary in whether they eat small amounts of butter or cheese. Some do, some don't. But most of them, I have found, don't have meat in their homes. They all seem to agree that plant-based diets are anti-inflammatory, give us higher energy levels throughout the day, lead to greater health and longevity. So, Sanjay, does the way you eat personally fit with what I'm describing?
The way that I eat personally fits pretty well. I'm a person, I have three young children in the home, a very busy life. And I have a wife who's very health conscious, but sort of fits a little bit into the paradigm of what I was describing earlier. Wants to not just be told what to do, but to have a little bit more of the why. I'm fortunate because I get to really dive into the why of things and be able to explain it. But for example, we do not keep meat in the home, and that was a decision that we made because it was. It's just too easy to go to the meat, and it also, I think, sent a message to our children that this could be a daily food, and we didn't want to be thought of as a daily food. We will allow meat if we go out somewhere, if someone offers us meat at someone's home, for example. We may not turn it down, that sort of thing. So we're not absolutists with regard to that, but I think that. We've tried to send some important signals to each other and to our kids. We also keep a vegetable garden, which I have found to be very effective I have three little girls, very effective for them because they're fascinated by it. They're fascinated just in seeing something grow. the fact that food that comes out of the ground is something you can eat. I mean, just basic things that I think maybe we take for granted, but if you've grown up in a world of completely processed foods, big grocery stores with lots of shiny packages, you may not even know where some of that food comes from. And so that's what we've tried to adopt, and it works pretty well for us. We're a lot better than we were. I just tell you quickly, I don't want to belabor the point, but look, when I was in residency. Doing my residency as a doctor, working in a hospital, the food choices I had at the hospital were terrible food choices. I mean, it was so ironic in retrospect that you're working as a person who's learning how to heal, and yet the system is not designed that you can actually take care of yourself. You recognize it at the time, but it becomes in part cultural. Look, if a hospital says it's okay to have a McDonald's, have a lot of food that's high in sodium, lots of meats, lots of fatty foods, the hospital says it's okay. I mean, is it really that bad? It takes some further education to dispel some of those notions.
It does. And when you mentioned that you have a vegetable garden, I thought, well, that's wonderful. I wish all of us could, or many more of us could, have that. I even think we should have a Department of Homegrown Security, actually.
I like that. I like that.
Yeah, I think, we have long supply chains bringing us our food. Food travels thousands of miles often before it gets to us. And those long supply chains are subject to rupture at different spots. You're talking about food security. Having a Department of Homegrown Security, if we got behind and really supported family gardens, vegetable gardens, and vacant lots, and community-supported agriculture, I think we would have a healthier people, we'd have people more connected to nature, we'd have our children more involved, which would be a wonderful thing, and I think we'd have more security.
We did these stories, John, where, and this is not hyperbolic. This is true. It's going to sound hyperbolic. But we would do these stories in Chicago where people who were living in certain communities who subsequently developed their own urban gardening and very successful at it, but prior to that would say it would be easier for them to get a handgun than to get a tomato. It was shocking to me that could be the case, but it was true, and I actually set out with this woman one day and said, all right, let's go get a tomato. Show me. And it was a process of being on two different buses, walking quite a distance, eventually finding a store that had a very small selection and small supply of vegetables, and hoping that, you know, they had some tomatoes that day. It just was not easy at all. The system for her was not designed for her to be able to eat healthy. So in her case, she took it on herself to start a small urban garden in her community outside of Chicago, and it was effective. It did all the things that you say. People were all responsible for it. It connected them to nature. It also connected them to themselves, to each other within that community. I mean, even if you took out the health benefits for a second, all of our social activities, it seems, in the United States, many developed nations revolve around food and drink. That's what the social activities revolve around. Even children's birthday parties, serving food that is not healthy and drinking alcohol. And yet when you have an urban garden like this, you have a social, you know, space, a place where people are coming together over still food, but healthy food in this case. And I just found it to be just a different environment. And that's just leaving aside the health benefits of being able to eat that food that's grown locally. We've also seen, as you point out, working for a breaking news network, when there are food outbreaks, salmonella, E. coli, things like that, it always does raise this question for people. Where is our food coming from? How many steps along the way from farm to fork? You know, how many places of possible contamination? So, again, for that reason alone, just to have safe food, secure food, those messages, I think, do resonate with people, even before you get into the obvious health benefits physiologically for the body.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and you mentioned children's birthdays and how we serve ice cream and cake. And our culture seems to have normalized eating a lot of sugar as a form of reward or celebration. And it's odd to me. I mean, it's odd to me that we don't see that as odd. It's so normalized that no one says, well, we're celebrating your birthday by eating a food that's going to, if you eat a lot of it, and we do in this culture, it's going to compromise your health. It's going to undermine your ability to function. It's going to probably shorten your life. It's going to probably add weight to you that you don't need. There's so many ways in which we have normalized eating foods as celebration and reward that really aren't good for us.
Yeah, I'm looking, no one probably knows more about this particular topic than you. I mean, you've lived it.
Yes.
You know, I know. But I will say something, and this is something that it's not a full answer to this, but I will say that if you look at the consumption of sugar and high fructose corn syrup, and you look at sort of the trajectory that our country has been on, and you look at what happened in the 70s with you know, Senate commissions even that were trying to determine what constituted a healthy diet in the United States at that time. There were a few studies, as you, I'm sure, know, that specifically were looking at patients with hypercholesterolemia, very, very high cholesterols, typically for genetic reasons, and showing those patients had higher rates of heart disease, and then showing, as no one would be surprised, that, you know, eating meats and stuff like that and eating fatty foods raised those cholesterol levels. And we became a country that really tried to focus at least on low fat. Now, some would say we haven't done a very good job of that, but you know, it's compared to where we were and the trajectory that we were on at that time. But I think if you look at what happened around that time as well, you started seeing a great increase in sugar consumption. It was already up, going up. You could look at the significant increases around the time of sugar refining and all that, but it was continuing to go up, and it went up even more now because you know, food's going to taste good. If you took all the fat out of it, you put sugar into it, Snackwell cookies became a health food. You know, that was what people believed. And then you complicated matters even further because high fructose corn syrup, heavily subsidized by the government, corn, very cheap as a result, used not just as a sweetener, but also as a humectant to make foods moist. Okay, it's not sweet, but it's soft. People don't realize that's probably sugar as well that's doing that. And what happened over those 40 years that we made this strategic decision in the United States? Everybody knows what happened. Obesity rates went up for adults and children. Rates of diabetes went up for adults and children. Heart disease remains the biggest killer for men and women alike. Nothing got better. Everything got worse. And sugar was a big culprit probably all along. People still don't think of sugar as something that can raise your bad cholesterol levels. Fat does that. They don't see it as sugar. They don't realize what sugar does to your liver and how liver will start churning out those LDLs because our bodies were never designed to absorb 130 pounds of sugar a year, which is about the average, I understand, of sugar consumption in the United States. We would get fruit, you know, a few times a year after harvest when the fruit was literally falling from the trees. It was mixed with a lot of fiber. Our bodies didn't evolve to be able to absorb it this way. So it got normalized. Other foods were understandably more demonized, but the perception was, well, that's the bad food. These other foods must not be as bad. They may, in fact, be good. It could even be health foods, such as the case of certain, you know, things like Snackwell cookies, or I'm picking on them, but there are lots of examples.
Yeah, we evolved, actually, with the sweetest thing for most humans that they could ever get was fruit. But that was seasonal. You know, how often a year are berry bushes ripe? And now berries are foods that people are told to eat to be healthier and to lose weight and to get off sweets.
That's right.
But I want to shift a little bit to another question. We eat too much of just about everything. I mean, that seems to be the case. You just look at our waistlines. The traditional Okinawans are renowned for being the longest lived and healthiest people that have ever been thoroughly studied. And among the many features of their lives that have contributed to this is a tradition they call Hara Hachibu, which means eating only until you're 80% full and then stopping. Now, Sanjay, a rumor has it that you've been known to whisper this phrase out loud when eating in restaurants with your wife. I want to ask you first, are those rumors true? And seriously, does eating only until 80% full make sense from a neuroscience perspective?
Yep. The rumors are true. And I do it with my wife, and I do it with my friends as well when we go out to eat. And I think it used to drive them crazy in the beginning. But now the people I spend a fair amount of time with, they may whisper it themselves. I think I've spent the time not only explaining the what, but the why again. And I was fascinated by this. I spent time in Okinawa. We were working on this this film called Chasing Life. And same thing. I just, you know, what can we learn from folks that are the longest lived people on the planet? I mean, what are they doing? It's kind of like that scene in When Harry Met Sally. I'll have what she's having, you know. And when I would ask them about their longevity, Hara Hachibu was a phrase that kept coming up. And at first, you know, it sounded a bit Pollyannish, and it sounded a little bit impractical to me. I mean, who knows when they're 80% full? I mean, how do you even know that? And also the idea that it could have such benefit. But, you know, we really started to investigate. And there's just a couple of truisms that I think apply here. One is that it just takes time for our brains to catch up to our stomachs that, in fact, we're satiated. There's a satiety center in the brain, and it gets signals from, you know, your GI tract that, in fact, you've had enough food, you've had enough of certain types of foods, you don't need to eat anymore. But it's not an immediate feedback loop. It takes time. It can take 15 minutes for the brain to actually catch up to the stomach. Problem is that many Americans can eat another three-course meal in those 15 minutes. So by the time we're really getting the satiety signals, we've typically way overeaten. We've really significantly overeaten. And so by simply pushing the plate away at a point when you're not full, and just giving it a little bit of time, recognizing that you'll be fine, you'll feel full. Just give it a little bit of time, 15 minutes or so. Really, I think, leaves an impression on people. And there's all sorts of different things that where the brain and the body are interacting in this way that if you understand it better, it'll help you eat not just the right foods, but the way that you eat will change as well.
You know, when you asked who knows when you're 80% full, I think the people who know are more often the people who are eating slowly.
Yeah.
Because if you're you know, on a rampage, you know, chowing it down, you're not going to notice the signals that your body is sending you. They do have a delay to them, but the signals are reliably sent. They come through nerves. They come through chemical messengers. The signals are there, but many of us have become remarkably adept at ignoring them.
Right. Mindlessly, you know, eating, becoming really adept at ignoring the signals. And there's all sorts of traps, you know, that's one of them, is that our brain has not yet told us to stop eating. So we have to, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you're on autopilot. You have to sometimes take the controls as a human being. You've got to be in control. You can't just rely on everything being on autopilot. Another example that I like to give that I imagine you know well is that if you look at the areas that really signal thirst versus hunger in the brain and look at some of the peptides, you know, the signaling mechanisms, if you will, there's a lot of overlap. And all that to say that we oftentimes, in a country where we have plenty of resources, where there's plenty of food available, when you get that pang, if you will, that pang of peptides that are now signaling, hey, man, I need something. I need something right now. If you live in an area of abundance and you say you need something, that something you're going to reach for is probably food instead of drinking water because you're actually dehydrated. And so as a country, we walk around chronically dehydrated and overstuffed because of that. In areas of the world where they're not so resource intensive as we're in the United States, they don't have that luxury. So yes, they're eating less, but they're probably eating more in line in some places with the way humans should eat. So there's all sorts of different reasons for that in terms of how we evolved. But I think that really happens, this chronic dehydration and overstuffed sort of America that we're living in.
You know, I think when we are thirsty, a lot of us drink soda pop. And so we're getting water, we're hydrating, but we're also getting a lot of sugar and sometimes chemicals as well. And the numbers of us that actually drink water, just drink water, maybe filtered water, because we don't want to drink water that smells like a swimming pool, but drinking healthy water, I think that is one of the keys to a healthy life, actually, is to drink water rather than all the beverages that are sold to us. I mean, you can drink them sometimes, but if your primary form of hydration is soda pop or coffee, or, you know, then you're drinking 6-7 cups a day and you start to get into problems. We have somehow made water a peasant thing.
That is interesting, and we're very vulnerable to the advertising around, I mean, water or I should say the advertising around other drinks other than water, more so. I think it's interesting if you look at what happened with bottled water and how in some ways adding an increased cost to the water may have been beneficial to certain segments of the population because they actually now thought, well, you know, this is something of greater value. Obviously, I'm paying for it, so I will drink it. But you're right. Water has gotten short shrift in this. And if the substitute is a sugary drink, it's a sugar delivery device is what it is. And there's nothing to mitigate the rate of absorption from sugar in a drink. And sugar in a drink, even more than anything else, probably, is the fastest way that sugar is getting into your body and hitting your liver like a tsunami wave, and your liver has not evolved to be able to handle that. It's a huge problem. You know, sugary drinks, and this is, you know, it's a point that, you know, we've made for a long time. I did a special on 60 Minutes, just all about sugar. it's striking to me that it's still taking so long for people to understand the perils of that. You know, the advertising campaigns that you see around sugary drinks are, look, it can be part of a healthy diet. You just need to walk around the park a few times or whatever it may be. It is not that simple at all. And the idea that it's not just the calories, but in this case, the type of calorie and the rate at which those calories are absorbed that's making a difference. It's worth explaining that to people, because I think when you do, it makes a mark. They actually are more likely to modify their behaviors because of it.
And what would you have parents tell their children? The kids are bombarded with ads. The soda pop companies are very sophisticated in targeting children. It's almost like they've put a bullseye on their backs. And parents who want their kids to eat healthier and to make healthier choices and to understand why, what would you encourage them to say to their kids?
I think that kids are not born necessarily with these sorts of cravings. I think that, certainly practicing what you preach as a parent. I'm speaking in part now, or mainly mostly as a parent of three little kids, because I've had to be somebody who actually did what I talk about. I had to practice what I preach. And so I've seen this now for 12 years with my own kids. My oldest is 12. I think you really have to practice what you preach. You have to make sure that there's a lot of, the healthy food choices available, and have, very concrete discussions about food. I had a funny sort of story when we did this sugar story for 60 Minutes. It was right before school started, and I went to one of the parent-teacher picnics ahead of time. And all these kids are around, and lots of parents, and the principal of the school comes up and says in a very loud voice, all these kids could hear her, "Dr. Gupta, I just want you to know, I watched your thing on 60 Minutes, and as a result of that, we're no longer going to have any sugary foods in the school," including at that picnic, which typically had, various sugary, options for the kids. And so all of a sudden, I was this guy who was a bit of a pariah among all the children. But, I do think I was willing to tolerate that, because I think now when I look at, this was a few years ago, when I look at that class and I look at my kids, there's not this overwhelming craving for those foods. I think we've just set an example in our household to not have to have it. I think my kids, they actually don't feel well if they're eating too much sugar. And we talk about that, and we talk about the impact on their bodies. So it's a constant discussion. Food is important. I think it ends up being a thing that families don't talk about much, or it's a simple afterthought. They just want to get calories into their kids as quickly as possible, and they don't have the conversation about something as integral to our lives as food. We do. We're not great, perfect by any means. We make mistakes in our family, but we have the conversations, and I think it does leave an impression on them.
Well, I'm glad that you do have those conversations. That's so important. I grew up eating an awful lot of sweets. My dad owned an ice cream company. Famously.
I've heard of that company.
I ate a ton of ice cream. I drank Coke. I mean, eating something like carrots, or which are pretty sweet as vegetables go, it tasted like cardboard to me then. My taste buds were hijacked by the amount of sugar that I was eating. And then I made changes, and over time stopped eating junk and ate much more healthfully. And I began to notice subtler flavors that I had just been unaware of before.
Yeah.
And I began to appreciate them and really find them to be delicious and exquisite. And then if I were to be back at my folks' house and they'd serve ice cream and I'd eat it, my taste buds would feel overpowered. They'd feel overwhelmed. It would feel actually unpleasant, too sweet.
Right.
And I noticed that I was actually becoming more aware and sensitive to life in some ways by eating healthfully, that I wasn't drenching myself in hyper-stimulating foods. And that gave me a more appreciation for all kinds of things that take place in life that aren't manufactured to overwhelm.
It's really interesting to hear that, John, especially again from your perspective, because I think a lot of people suspect what you're saying to be true, but maybe not experienced it the way that you have. I think that's something that people are going to want to hear. I also have sort of found that we have a challenging job sometimes in medical journalism when talking about these things, because in some ways, and I don't want to oversimplify here, but in some ways what we're trying to do when we talk about some of these topics is we're trying to prove a negative. We're trying to say if you eat these foods, if you avoid these foods, then nothing will happen to you. And by nothing, we mean you're not going to have a heart attack, you're not going to develop the chronic diseases that are so associated with food. Nothing will happen to you if you do this. It's not the most inspiring message, and people may say, well, how would I know that nothing wasn't going to happen to me regardless of what I ate? How do I know that it was the food? How do I draw that connection, that line between the two? And which is why what you said I think is so important. The idea that, look, even if you're a skeptic and you say, I'm not sure that this food's going to reverse my coronary artery disease or reduce my risk of these sorts of problems, it actually feels pretty good to eat this food. I feel good when I eat it. And when I eat these other foods, I feel not as good. I feel sluggish. I don't feel like I'm performing or I'm optimized as much as I could be. The idea that there's a more immediate feedback loop, I think that's part of human nature as well. What is the feedback loop here? When I eat those foods that science has shown, and I think most scientists and nutritionists and people in that world agree upon, are good foods in terms of reducing your risk, does it also feel good to eat those foods? Will I be better somehow? Will I think better? Will I perform better? Will I be more productive? Whatever the metric is that you're looking at, creating that feedback loop for yourself, I think, makes a big difference. When I'm, like I said, I rarely eat meat. When I started primarily eating a plant-based diet, I felt better. I even noticed little things like my running times improved. I shaved 45 seconds off my miles when I started doing that. And that meant something to me. I couldn't look inside my coronary arteries, but yeah, shaving 45 seconds off, I took a great deal of pride in that. So there were little things that I created in my own feedback loop that I think were important. In your case, the other foods just didn't taste good anymore. These foods actually tasted better, and you got more joy out of it. I think everyone needs to find that thing for themselves as well, as opposed to just listening to us talk about it reducing your risk of disease. That's like swatting at flies. I'm not telling you just to prevent disease. I'm telling you to optimize yourself. Wherever you are today, you can be better tomorrow, okay? Just take that and figure out how food plays into that equation for you.
I love what you're saying. You know, we in our culture, we have tended to define health as the absence of disease, which is a negative. It's nothing, really.
Right.
And what health actually is vitality and vibrancy and clear thinking and emotional resilience and shaving 45 seconds off your mile time and being stronger as you age and not losing vitality and not losing your vigor and not losing your potency. And there's so many ways that living in a healthy body, that you're feeding it the fuel that it is really designed to eat and functions best with, creates a better, higher quality of life. And yet, we've normalized being overweight. We've normalized eating foods that suppress our emotions and distance us from life and numb us out. And so it takes an act of will sometimes, or courage, or some kind of, sometimes it takes a problem to motivate people.
Right.
But I think what you're doing, what we're trying to do, is giving people the social support, the emotional support, so it becomes a little easier to do the right thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know what you've seen in your own worldview or among your social circle. I will say on a positive note, I do feel that things are changing. I think people, the average consumer, probably does think about this more than they did. I couldn't imagine going to a neighborhood barbecue 5-10 years ago, and if I opted out of not getting the ribs and just instead getting salad and a bunch of vegetables, that somehow that would be an assault on my masculinity in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it almost felt that way, right? I mean, this guy, he's not even going to eat any meat. I mean, but now I see actually, a fair number of people doing the same thing. And, people who are, full of machismo and they're like, I'm passing on the meat. I'm good. I actually feel much better when I eat this food. and I don't need that food. And then I'm drinking water. I don't need to drink a big Coke or something like that, or other soft drinks. So I do, in my own anecdotal thing, there does seem to be more awareness and more ability to eat that sort of way and have it feel normal.
Yes, it feels normal, and then it becomes easier, and then our kids can do it too with us. And you know, Sanjay, you mentioned earlier that you really didn't receive much nutritional or any nutritional education in medical school, and you have nevertheless persevered to understand and to learn more about how we can use the food we eat to prevent suffering, to save money, to enhance the quality of our lives in so many ways. And I have really great respect for physicians like you who take it upon yourself to do that. It's you're going uphill, and you're sharing it with people, and that is how the healing happens, I think. And I want to tell you, it's been an honor and a pleasure to speak with you today, and to bring your wisdom to our audience. On behalf of Ocean and myself, and of everyone involved, really, in the food revolution, I thank you. I thank you for your outstanding work, your integrity, your brilliance, and of course, for being with us today.
The feelings are so mutual, and I think for someone like you in particular, John, the legacy you're going to leave behind, the transformation that you've gone through in your own life, I mean, it's a story that everyone should hear, and I'm honored that you spent some time with me.
We've been talking with CNN's multiple Emmy award-winning chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, producer of The Last Heart Attack and author of many bestsellers, including Chasing Life. Sanjay, your educational efforts and your bold leadership are bringing wisdom and health to millions. We're so grateful for your brilliant reporting, for your leadership in both the media industry and in the medical community, for sharing your insights with our listeners, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
It's an honor, Ocean. Thank you for having me.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.